I think we need to listen to a lecture here by Larry Sabato, in which he details the politics and the political situation in a pretty good light. In other words, I think what he's saying rings true. So listen to Professor Larry Sabato and why LBJ did not kill JFK.
Some of the many questions that have arisen over the 50 years since President Kennedy's assassination. Look closely at the film recorded by Abraham Zapruder as the president's limousine passed through Dealey Plaza. We have slowed it down significantly for demonstration purposes. The time here is roughly 12:30 Central Standard Time, and the president's limousine is just completing the hairpin turn from Houston Street onto Elm Street, where the president was shot. President and Mrs. Kennedy are seated in the back of the convertible limousine. Seated in front of the president is Texas Governor John Connally. Seated in front of Mrs. Kennedy is Governor Connally's wife, Nellie Connally. From government and media reports, we know that Special Agent William R. Greer of the Secret Service was driving the presidential limousine. On his right sat Secret Service Agent Roy Kellerman, whose responsibilities included maintaining radio communications with the lead and follow cars, as well as scanning the route and getting out and standing near the president when the car stopped. There were four motorcycles, two on each side that flanked the rear of the presidential car. There were other motorcycle officers within the motorcade, but these four were there to provide some cover for the president and to keep back the crowd. On previous occasions, the president had requested that, to the extent possible, these flanking motorcycles keep back from the sides of his car. Immediately behind the president is the presidential follow car. This vehicle, a 1955 Cadillac 8-passenger convertible, was especially outfitted for the Secret Service. It followed closely behind the president's automobile. It carried 8 Secret Service agents, 2 in the front seat, 2 in the rear, and 2 on each of the right and left running boards. The agents in this car, under established procedure, had instructions to watch the route for signs of trouble. They were scanning not only the crowds, but the windows and roofs of buildings, overpasses, and crossings. They were instructed to watch particularly for thrown objects, for sudden actions in the crowd, for any movements toward the presidential car that could be threatening. The agents on the front of the running boards had directions to move immediately to positions just to the rear of the president and Mrs. Kennedy when the president's car slowed to a walking pace or stopped, or when the press of the crowd made it impossible for the escort motorcycles to stay in position on the car's rear flanks. The two agents on the rear of the running boards were to advance toward the front of the president's car whenever it stopped, or whenever it slowed down sufficiently for them to do so. Here is the moment of impact of the first shot that struck President Kennedy. Here is the moment of impact for the fatal headshot. To many people, the Zapruder film raises questions over whether the bullet that struck the president's head was fired from a gun that was behind him or in front of him. Notice that President Kennedy's head and upper torso are clearly thrown backward in a manner seemingly inconsistent with a shot coming from the rear. Some leading experts in physics have concluded that the recoil of the president's head proves that the fatal shot was not fired from the depository, but rather from a location in front of Kennedy's limousine. By no means is this analysis unanimously supported. Others use photographic and scientific perspectives to insist that the Zapruder film shows that the president initially fell forward, having been hit from behind. Then the jet propulsion factor took effect, pushing the president backwards. Jackie Kennedy is in shock, jumps up. It's clear that she is trying to retrieve a piece of the president's skull that has fallen on the back of the limousine, on the trunk of the limousine. But it's also very dangerous because the driver is getting ready to speed up to go to Parkland Hospital. So her Secret Service agent, Clint Hill, who was on her side of the car, is making a mad dash. He had already started to run, having realized that President Kennedy was under attack, but he was just short of the car. He was unable to prevent that bullet from striking President Kennedy's head. He was, however, able to push Mrs. Kennedy into the car, at which point Clint Hill covered the First Lady and the President with his body, trying to protect them as they went down under the overpass and on the way to Parkland Hospital, which was 5 minutes away. There were people on the other side of the overpass. They had no idea what had happened. They were waving, but of course, instead of seeing the President, they saw a foot sticking out. It was Clint Hill's foot. For a long time, people thought it was President Kennedy's, but it was actually Clint Hill's foot as he was trying to cover them and trying to make room for his body. Listen to some of the chaos, confusion, and incorrect reports that were recorded by the Dallas Police Department in the minutes surrounding the assassination. This is the sound of Agent Willie Price, who was stationed at the Trademark, the site to which the President was traveling for his luncheon speech. He also accompanied President Johnson to Parkland Hospital, reporting over the police radio system what he saw when he reached the hospital.
The President's head was practically blown off.
The call time of his report was 12:40, but the public wouldn't hear the official news for about another hour. Upon arrival at Parkland Hospital, Governor Connally, who had fainted from shock and loss of blood, regained consciousness and was immediately helped onto a stretcher. About 1:20, the bullet was found on the stretcher by Parkland's chief engineer, Darrell Tomlinson. But later, Tomlinson was uncertain that this stretcher was the one used for Connally, and others wondered whether the bullet had been planted in order to implicate Lee Harvey Oswald. Further questions have been raised about the condition of this bullet, which was only slightly compacted at its base, despite having allegedly passed through two bodies and broken bones in Governor Connally. The ambiguous nature of the visual evidence can lead to diametrically opposite conclusions, and that was true of the only two official governmental reports that have been conducted since the assassination. Remember, in the year after the President's assassination, the Warren Commission concluded that the assassination was the result of the actions of a single person, a lone gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald. More than a decade after the Warren Commission's findings were released, another government investigation would be opened by the House Select Committee on Assassinations at the U.S. House of Representatives. This second governmental body flatly contradicted the Warren Commission by concluding that the assassination of President Kennedy was the result of a conspiracy. So which government conclusion is correct? Was the assassination really the work of just one person, or were others involved? What other person or groups of people had reason to want to murder President Kennedy? We'll discuss some of those possibilities in our next segment. Proof is often lacking to support plausible conjecture, as well as semi-reliable hearsay and logical guesswork. Unfortunately, contrary to what the experts say on TV crime shows, the same is true for some of the physical evidence. Where you stand on that evidence depends on where you sat about November 22, 1963, or thereafter. Take the medical findings and judgments of those who saw President Kennedy right after his fatal shooting. President Kennedy arrived at Parkland Hospital within a few minutes of the shooting at around 12:35. The physicians worked desperately to save the president's life, but they knew the situation was extremely grim. Doctors noted the president was having trouble breathing and had no palpable pulse. He had a large, gaping wound in the right rear part of his head, with substantial damage and exposure of brain tissue and a considerable loss of blood. It was much too late for miracles. The time of John Fitzgerald Kennedy's death was somewhat arbitrarily fixed by the doctors as being 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. They cited a gunshot wound to the head as the cause of death. Assistant Press Secretary Malcolm Kilduff had accompanied Kennedy and made the official announcement of the president's death to journalists gathered in the hospital. Following that, the doctors gave an impromptu press conference. The lead doctor told the press that he could not identify the entry point for the bullet, the one that had shattered the president's skull. This statement was corroborated by other doctors who said that the head wound could have been either the exit wound from the neck, or it could have been a tangential wound, as it was simply a large, gaping loss of tissue. Not long after Kennedy expired, the White House staff and Secret Service, with Mrs. Kennedy at their side, began wheeling JFK's body out of Parkland Hospital. The Dallas County Medical Examiner tried to stop them, noting that Texas law required an autopsy to be performed in Texas. He was correct, by the way. Kennedy's aides refused to comply, and armed agents stepped in to remove the president's body and transport it back to Air Force One. It is possible that some of the unending controversy about the JFK autopsy would have been resolved, or would never have occurred, had the autopsy been done in Dallas. But the official autopsy was not conducted in Texas, and many hours later, it occurred at Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland. The autopsy was inadequate in other ways as well. The Bethesda physicians did not confer with the Parkland medical team before they began the procedure, and they did not have the opportunity to examine the president's clothing, which was removed at Parkland Hospital. This was unfortunate, as the bullet holes in JFK's coat and shirt were critical in understanding one bullet's trajectory. On top of it all, the doctors at Bethesda felt pressure from President Kennedy's brother Robert, Mrs. Kennedy, and other White House aides to finish as quickly as possible. The family simply refused to leave the hospital until the autopsy was finished and the body was prepared to lie in state at the White House. Please see the book for more details. The National Archives and Records Administration has never released the autopsy photos to the press or public. They are, after all, fundamentally private medical records. It was completely appropriate to withhold the photos in the years immediately following JFK's death. But after a half century, this is pure American history, and it's a vital piece of the assassination puzzle. It's time to release all the medical evidence so that everyone with an interest in the case can sort out the truth from varying perspectives.
I want to take this opportunity to express my appreciation for the hundreds of thousands of messages, nearly 800,000 in all, which my children and I have received over the past few weeks. The knowledge of the affection in which my husband was held by all of you has sustained me, and the warmth of these tributes is something I shall never forget. Whenever I can bear to, I read them. All his bright light gone from the world. All of you who have written to me know how much we all loved him and that he returned that love in full measure. It is my greatest wish that all of these letters be acknowledged. They will be, but it will take a long time to do so. But I know you will understand. Each and every message is to be treasured, not only for my children, but so that future generations will know how much our country and people in other nations thought of him.
Longest-running sagas in American history, involving hundreds of subplots. facts and quasi-facts have dribbled out over five decades. Quite a few of these facts are unverifiable or only partially verifiable, which does not necessarily mean they are incorrect. Stories are told by respectable and dubious witnesses alike that are based on murky memories of long ago events. Some legitimate evidence is contradictory. The cast of characters in this historical enterprise, many of them colorful and quirky, could fill a bookshelf of Shakespearean plays. The search for the truth of JFK's assassination is like the quest for El Dorado, the mythical city of gold that tantalized European explorers in the 16th century. Inspired by vague clues and Amerindian legends, these explorers spent years in the wilderness hoping to strike it rich, but often died of disease and starvation instead. This class could never cover all the details in the short time we have together. For those who are interested, my book, The Kennedy Half Century, is a synthesis of what we know after 50 years. It's not a misguided attempt to solve the insoluble or to figure out every detail of the assassination. 4 days after JFK was laid to rest in Arlington Cemetery, President Lyndon Johnson asked the Chief Justice of the United States to head a federal probe into the assassination. LBJ signed an executive order later that day that created a commission to ascertain, evaluate, and report upon the facts relating to the assassination of the late President John F. Kennedy and the subsequent violent death of the man charged with the assassination. The Earl Warren Commission, Warren Commission for short, was doomed from the start because Washington's power brokers, led by the new president himself, were far more interested in preserving domestic tranquility than in finding the full truth. They wanted a report that would first calm citizens' jangled nerves by reassuring them that a lone nut named Lee Harvey Oswald had acted completely on his own. Conspiratorial chatter, so the reasoning went, would only undermine public trust in government and perhaps even lead to war if fingers were pointed at Fidel Castro or the Soviets. Just 13 months earlier, the United States had narrowly avoided a nuclear conflagration with Russia, and the Cold War was still freezing. The public was suspicious of Russia, Cuba, and more. In the immediate aftermath of the assassination, 62% of the American people believed that their president had been killed in a conspiracy. Official Washington felt the need to respond. The Warren Commission launched its investigation of the JFK assassination in February 1964. Acting on President Johnson's instructions, Earl Warren urged the commission to complete its work before July, when the presidential campaign would likely heat up. So, in effect, there was a political calendar for a murder investigation. Over the next 6 months, the commission recorded the testimony of 552 people, examined thousands of documents, and held 51 sessions. Commission members, however, skipped many of the meetings. The hard work was assigned to assistants like Arlen Specter, who invented the single bullet theory to reconcile apparently indisputable facts that emerged in the course of the Warren investigation, including the reality that Oswald or any marksman needed a certain number of seconds to fire a rifle repeatedly within the elapsed time of the shooting. Specter and his colleagues had screened the publicly unseen amateur home movie shot by businessman Abraham Zapruder in Dealey Plaza, which cast grave doubts on the validity of the FBI report. It showed Governor Connally groaning in agony less than 2 seconds after Kennedy was shot in the back. The commission realized that no marksman, however skilled, could fire 2 shots within 2 seconds from a bolt-action rifle. Specter's single-bullet theory, which asserted that the bullet striking JFK's back continued on cleanly through Kennedy's throat to cause all of Connally's many wounds, neatly solved the dilemma. Other Warren Commission staffers investigated the Jack Ruby case and concluded that Ruby had impulsively killed Oswald in a fit of pique. Other pieces of the assassination puzzle were similarly assembled into the overall pattern, some easily, others with difficulty. The time pressures guaranteed that all of the evidence could not be gathered and sifted. Many key witnesses were not even interviewed. A future U.S. president, Gerald Ford, was so anxious to close the case that he changed the description of the president's back wound so that it would simply comply with Specter's single bullet theory. Ford would later insist that he was trying to make the report more precise. On September 24, 1964, the Warren Commission presented its final report to the President of the United States.
To the White House in Washington comes the final verdict on the fateful tragedy which engulfed the nation 10 months ago. U.S. Chief Justice Earl Warren is the bearer of the sad epilogue. The report on the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, compiled by the commission created by President Johnson, which was headed by the Chief Justice himself.
Johnson released a letter of appreciation later that day. He said, "The commission, I know, has been guided throughout by a determination to find and tell the whole truth of these terrible events. This is our obligation to the good name of the United States of America and to all men everywhere who respect our nation, and above all, to the memory of President Kennedy." The Warren Commission concluded that Oswald and Ruby had committed their crimes without help or encouragement from anyone else. While some prominent journalists, such as CBS's Walter Cronkite, were privately skeptical, news organizations generally did not question the Warren Commission's findings. This was an era very different from today, when columnists and publishers were often the government's lapdogs instead of their watchdogs. In editorials, the nation's newspapers were overwhelmingly deferential to the Warren Commission. Initially, most Americans accepted the conclusions of the Warren Report. After it was released, only 31% of the public still believed that JFK had been a victim of a conspiracy, exactly half what the percentage had been in the immediate aftermath of the assassination. Ironically, in its rush to tamp down the rumors surrounding the assassination, the Warren Commission guaranteed the perpetuation of conspiracy theories for years to come. In the early 1960s, the public was thought incapable of handling the truth. Rather, it had to be spoon-fed a convenient, calming version of events. The Warren Commission gave people a sanitized, abbreviated version of the assassination. The public was condescendingly told to accept the official account without subversive, unpatriotic questioning. The commission laid the groundwork for the cynicism that became deeply rooted in the late 1960s and the 1970s. That is, a profound distrust of the official government story about anything. Instead of being viewed as authoritative, government pronouncements became mocked as deceitful propaganda from the Ministry of Truth. Chief among the failings of the Warren Commission was the fact that it did not interview significant numbers of eyewitnesses. There isn't time to detail the long list here, but you can find many of their stories within the pages of the Kennedy Half Century, including those of Bill and Gail Newman, who were in Dealey Plaza with their children when the shots rang out. H.B. McLean, a Dallas motorcycle cop who was part of the presidential motorcade. Marilyn Sitzman, who assisted her boss Abraham Zapruder in steadying himself while filming the president passing through Dealey Plaza. Elsie Dorman and Robert Croft, two amateur photographers who captured images of the president's motorcade as it drove through Dealey Plaza. Jim and Patricia Towner and their daughter Tina, who also were taking film and photos in Dealey Plaza seconds before the assassination. Mary Woodward, Maggie Brown, Aurelia Lorenzo, and Ann Donaldson all worked for the Dallas Morning News in 1963, and all of them were standing on the north curb of Elm Street during the assassination, Elm Street being the street where the assassination occurred. A.J. Milliken, who had been standing near Woodward and her colleagues, When he heard what he said, were a total of 8 shots coming from various directions. Mary Moorman, who took the most famous still photograph of the moment the fatal bullet struck John Kennedy that you see here, a photo that may or may not show a man in a uniform behind the picket fence, and an apparent puff of white smoke that may or may not have been the aftermath of a gunshot. And also Victoria Adams, a young woman who watched the president die from the 4th floor of the Texas School Book Depository, and said after the shots were fired, she fled down the depository's back stairwell, supposedly the same stairwell that Oswald had to use to make his escape from the 6th floor. Adams testified that she did not see or hear Oswald in that stairwell immediately after the assassination. The staff of the Warren Commission seemed to view Adams not as a vital witness, but as a threat to their preferred timeline of events, and they alternately ignored and defamed her